The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2019 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2019. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
All right, well, we have in store for us. It's always great to be the sweeper at the end there, Ben.
You bet.
Yes.
I like it.
It's good to be here. And we thought perspectives from an accidental classical Christian parent might be a good way to put the bookend at the end of a day in which we've been talking about hospitality and what it means to come alongside our families. Started things out with Keith kind of setting us up and saying, hey, if we're going to be hospitable, we need to really understand our audience. This is kind of basic stuff. And we've had a great day with Chick-fil-A and kind of journeyed our way along this path. So, Ben, I know your story, but I want to just kind of introduce you to folks. Basically, what we're going to do is walk through kind of Ben's story, a little bit about what you're doing professionally. Also, gives insights, I think, on where students are today, where parents are today. Again, under this whole banner of we've got a lot of work to do, and we're in the relationship business, and there's a lot of need out there. But why are you an accidental classical Christian parent? I just want to start with that.
Accidental would. I think it starts with my own story. And by the way, real quick, you've succeeded at something that very few people do.
What is that?
Get me to wear a blazer.
Well,
that's a big victory, you know, for that. So I just wanted to give
I'll make note of that. I'm glad I can help.
So my story, so I was educated, went to a private Catholic school for high school and elementary school, a little short stint in public junior high, and then married a public school educator. My wife taught junior high in Arizona for 9 years and was educated as a public school educator. And at the time when we were dating, she would take me to these Bible studies that she led that were for homeschoolers. And so we would attend those together, you know. And I always vowed as a follower of Jesus, like, my kids were going to go into the public school and they were going to be salt and light. Like, that was the thing. That's what they were going to do. And so, you know, we started out, we got married, started having kids, and putting our kids in school. Eventually, they ended up in a charter school, my two boys, Joshua and Eli, and they were tested for gifted, talented. And that really threw us a curveball. Because we also noticed, like, our kids, you know, they were just thinking about the world differently and experiencing things differently, and, like, where do we take and educate them? And at the time, we then moved to Central Phoenix because of my work, and we ended up homeschooling. So that was interesting. Like, I never would have thought that I would ever have homeschooled my kids, given everything that I just shared with you all. And then, as God would have it, on our journey, we got the opportunity to move to Idaho. And when we came up to interview for the job that I was offered, we saw Ambrose. And we'd missed all the deadlines for the schools in Arizona to put our kids back in school from homeschooling, because we had homeschooled 3 years. And we saw Ambrose, and, like, we'd move for that school. And so that was our journey as a family, kind of my background in school and my education and my wife, but then also how our kids ended up in the classical Christian environment.
So is there something in particular, again, just as a lot of us, we're so in the movement, we live it every day, but as someone coming into it, what was it that made it so attractive to you?
Yeah, so for me in particular, like the transcendentals, beauty, truth, and goodness, the modes of conversation, the trivium, like these are all things in my work and my study and own personal research that I was already familiar with. And then I saw there's a school that actually teaches this way. I had no idea. Hmm. And so it was very appealing to me. Like, I remember the visit in Ambrose, walking around, I was like, I want to go back to school. Hmm. Like, I feel like I missed something.
Yeah.
So that was for me personally, I already was in tune with some of the really ancient principles and things that undergird the classical Christian environment. And then to find out that there was a place that
you'd never heard of it before.
Yeah, I'd heard of classical education, like specifically in Arizona, there's a whole host of schools,
Great Hearts
Academies, that are classical, but they're not classical Christian.
Yeah, so this is a real discovery. Yeah. So share a little bit of your own professional story, because this is entering too, kind of weaving in, like, yeah. what have you done in your professional work?
So a majority of my background's in professional athletics. I was actually a professional athlete, played competitive golf at the professional level for 7 years. And then after that, I ended up working in that environment, helping world-class competitors navigate personal and professional issues, part-time on the PGA Tour, Major League Baseball. And so I've been in high-performing environments. And even through that work, I've interacted with a lot of high-performing business leaders as well. So that aspect of my work of just seeing the world from that type of entertainment world and culture from the inside as an observer. If you're not an athlete, you're still not one of them. But I was inside those environments a lot. And so from a society that really advocates for achievement and performance and competition, as the Western society does, specifically the United States and the culture we live in, I had a chance to see that from a very interesting standpoint, and then helping people navigate personal and professional issues inside those environments. So now
that's evolved into, share about your work in ministry, because it's really unique what you're doing.
Yes, so we co-founded an organization called Love and Transformation Institute, which is essentially a leadership development nonprofit for the next generation, helping them navigate personal and professional issues, helping them build healthy culture in their lives. The correlation of love and the role that it plays structurally in creating change for somebody is at the central focus of the Institute. And so that's what we have an opportunity to do now.
Yeah. So your journey has not only taken you as a parent thinking through the lens of what's the right educational environment for your child, but you're also watching the culture begin to change around your students and your family. So what are you seeing? What's going on? I mean, again, Keith started the day out talking a lot about just, do we know the audience? Do we really know the students that walk through our doors? And even if we knew what they were like 10 years ago or 5 years ago, it's a rapidly changing environment.
Yeah, this is a bit of a broad question that we'll probably hit from a bunch of different angles. We live in a day and time that is hyper-competitive and hyper-perfectionistic. And I know that might sound, okay, well, what do you mean? What are you talking about? I think I would illustrate this by I'll characterize this by talking a little bit about how I operate. So I'm a bit of a cultural observer. I dig, I see problems, and I want to get information and figure out what's going on with them. So I'll research until I could connect dots. And I found eventually a report, because we're experiencing extreme levels of stress, anxiety, depression, even suicidal ideation going on in our culture. Anybody who's been reading, I won't go into statistics, it's out there, you can find it if you want to. And it's showing up in all environments. It's just a reality that's happening. Well, why is this happening is the question we have to ask. And I eventually found a report from the American Psychological Association on the increase in perfectionism in college students. And some of you may have hopefully found this report and read it, but it was a meta-analysis from 1989 to 2016 of college students. And they said in the report in 2016 that there's a hyper-perfectionism in this youngest generation that they've never seen in history. Characterized by three different types of perfectionism. One is self-oriented, the second is others-oriented, and the third is societally prescribed. So we are in a society that advocates for the perfectible self. And I do some consulting for public schools on mental health awareness, and when I was engaging with administrators and superintendents, they began hearing me talk about the competitive aspects of things, and that was something. You hear a lot about trauma. That's a big buzzword, obviously, today, especially in public schools. But when we started talking about the competitive streak, the nature of competition and individualism and perfectionism, they're like, that's what we keep seeing. We see this immense amount of pressure that people feel like they're under to perform, to succeed, and to excel. And it's like, well, what do we do with that? And so tied to my own story, I went through 7 years of anxiety, depression, and had suicidal ideation in my 20s. And I had never understood the effects of competition. You know, I was an elite athlete, the effects that had on my mental health. And so these variety of aspects and these things that are intertwined is showing up in young people today.
Right.
So when they're coming into our environments, they're coming in with increased levels of stress, increased levels of anxiety just from Western society as a whole.
Yeah. Well, I want to, again, in the vein of hospitality, in the vein of understanding who these students are that come through our doors, and again, continue to weave your story along the way. You know, you intentionally, this accidental classical Christian discovery was, there is a difference in these environments that we're creating, especially as a bit of an antidote to what is increasingly a reality for most young people today. So how do you see, how is the work we do really the best position to try and offset that?
Yeah, so taking everything I just said right there, just as a cultural diagnosis or whatever, what people are experiencing, those people are showing up in our environments, right? And I will characterize this by saying two things. One, Keith said this morning that this is maybe the easiest time for people to be alive. Like, everything's really easy today in life. And I would say that I think that's true physically, but I think it's probably the hardest time philosophically to be alive, that people are confused, they're having a hard time understanding life, and they're showing up in our environments, struggling with life. And so knowing that, I will characterize what you're saying about hospitality, why it's so critical, knowing that these people are showing up in environments, students, teachers, in some of these conditions, that Epilogos at Ambrose, the end of the year celebration, I was struck by like the fact that I saw teachers hugging a child, my child, and how beautiful that was, and the expression of love and affection and concern, and how infectious that is for an environment. And you can't do that in the public school. So I think the classical Christian environment is an amazing environment for being able to help people think about life appropriately, which is what liberal arts and humanities does. Those are our ability to think about life and think about things like love and the way it really does integrate into all of life, where there's tremendous opportunity in the public schools, you know, to be a machine and to learn. But we're having a very difficult time. How do we think about life today? Yeah. And that's why I think the classical Christian environment, specifically for my kids, because I did an observation on a public school campus recently, and I was astonished at the amount of opportunity in front of them. I saw kids welding, doing engineering, electronics, all of it right there. And I came home to my wife, and I'm like, why are we in a classical Christian school again? But then I remember the intangibles, the intrinsic things that really shape a person. Yeah. And help us think about life is...
Well, and that so tension is very much where so many parents are today, that we live in a utilitarian culture, so you look at face value, and I don't know how many parents... I've never had a parent come and ask about welding. That would be a new request. But I could see more about college or more about practical job skills. So there's a utilitarian ethic that's part of our culture.
Yeah.
And yet it misses the heart of what is really going to be the right antidote to these anxieties and these challenges that teens are facing.
Yeah, or even if it's, you know, being able to be done with their first year of college by the time you exit high school.
Right.
You know, there's
concurrent credits.
Yeah, the push to excel and to move on. But for me, there are just things, like I came up to you after the end of Epilogos and said, like, I just love the fact that my son's teacher can give him a hug and can express love to him.
And it's things that we don't even know how. Again, that would probably never make it to our brochure of come to our school and we're going to give you an appropriate side hug. You know? Like, but oh my goodness, that is just like oxygen for young people, and it's being denied.
Yeah.
And so in this litany of challenges, like, where does that even fit? Like the most basic things that, you know, and again, I think part of what the pushback might be, gosh, Ben, well, no, we're not in the public school. We all know there are challenges there, and we pray for those people, but we're in these wonderful classical Christian schools. So, and yet those needs are just as real in terms of we do want to be free to hug and pray and connect and the great ideas, and we'll come back to that in a minute, but I mean, we're talking about shaping an affection. What does that really mean, and why is that?
Well, the intensity of, for any child growing up, to understand that they're valuable, and as much as a parent will tell their kid that they're loved and that they love them and care about them, there's all of these other inputs. You know, you talk about the 301.
Yeah.
You know, school's over and they get exposed to the world, and it's all attacking their value as a person. I don't remember who it was earlier today. Say valuable. Are you valuable? Are you capable?
I'm sure it's Keith McCurdy because he comes up.
I think it was Elizabeth Dixon, actually.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, Keith,
it was you? Okay. All right.
We've been giving Keith's come up in every single talk.
I
want
to give credit
today.
Where credit is due, yes. But that idea of value, we had a conversation at our table about it, is that's a big thing. Worth and value, and especially when loneliness is on the rise as well.
Yeah.
You know, and there's plenty of data out there to talk about. So why are people so lonely in a culture today that's so connected, supposedly connected? And that's why I think, you know, an environment of affection and care and love and concern, which is what I witness at Ambrose, by and large. Not a perfect school. There's no perfect school. Sorry to burst anybody's bubble. You know, but that's the reality, is that we can provide something to them that people are hungry for, I think.
Yeah.
At least in my experience. Our family has experienced that there.
So when we think about, again, a lot of us are thinking, what do we have to offer to a world that's coming through our doors? And again, sometimes the obvious things like the hug is actually a huge value, a differentiator that we don't even see under us and right in front of us. So what are some of the other things when we go back to, we read the great books, we engage the great ideas, how are those, you started down this path, but just talk a little bit more about when you think about like the three questions that everyone's got to answer, like if how is the work we're doing actually attending to the very deepest soulish parts of our identity?
Yeah, so you have these questions, these essential questions of life and meaning that everybody's trying to answer. And when you introduce the ideas, the great ideas of all of history, like my son just went through the fifth grade and the theme was the great ideas. And they get exposed to these things and things like beauty, truth, and goodness, the transcendentals, you begin to broaden their scope and view of how life is lived and how people have written about it and how they've been exposed to it. And I think that goes on to, even in some ways, even if they don't know the question at hand, it's helping them think through life. And that is what I hear when I sit with young people today, because I do a lot of mentoring with people under the age of 30. They're going, how do I think about life? And it is a big need and concern. And I think the classical Christian environment facilitates that. And it's a very hospitable thing to come alongside someone and understand their need and concern in that, and then be able to help them get their questions answered. And so I see that in the great ideas, in the transcendentals, the relationship between beauty, truth, and goodness, and how those are interconnected.
So how are we doing in terms of connect? Because the idea is you're exposing these great ideas and then connecting them. What are the, as you look at it, maybe your own children, just experiences that you're seeing in their lives that are the ideas of the classroom that really touch those parts of who they are in their inner being?
Like which specifically, like the transcendentals?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so in my own background, I've done a lot of research on the Great Commandment as a framework for biblical maturity. And like I think there's a correlation between heart, mind, and strength and the transcendentals, beauty, truth, and goodness. And I think our heart is very drawn to beauty. And I think we live in a culture that leads with beauty now. It leads with beauty, emotion, and experience. And then you have the mind, obviously our intellectual processing of life. Learning how to love God with the mind, is truth. It's driven by that. And then goodness, virtue, the development and shaping of the affections, but lived out in action, I think is where we see people's strength displayed. Mm-hmm. And so I think as Jesus has encouraged us to love him completely, holistically with ourselves, heart, mind, and strength, I think there is a correlation, at least I see, and I teach my kids this at home as a parent. And that's why I love it so much, the partnering of a classical Christian environment and these things that they hear and then the things that we're doing at home and the ability for those things to interconnect. Because yeah. What we're trying to do is shape a home filled with love and a philosophy of love, and it connects with the school. Right.
So, you've got a perspective coming into the school that maybe we didn't see because we're in it all day long. So, I'll be the marketing guy for a minute. Help me figure out what do I need to say to this hungry world outside my doors that would be maybe a more something that you thought, gosh, I wish I understood that earlier on. I mean, obviously, you came into this accidentally and later. Are there some things that really have it made it resonate for you? What's been the...
Golly, that's a big question. I would go to... So we were having a conversation at our table about the trivium, grammar, logic, and rhetoric, which are, for most people, even just the word trivium is not super accessible. It's like, what was that again? And then grammar, logic, and rhetoric, and you start to try to unpack it. But I think the way we were talking about it at our table was grammar, learning how to learn, logic, learning how to think, and then rhetoric, learning how to speak. Mm-hmm. Now, that may be oversimplified potentially for some in this room. You're like, well, that's too weak on that. But like, I think for any parent going, I want my kid to learn how to learn and learn appropriately, and then also learn how to reason through things. And then ultimately, can they speak? Can they engage? Can they defend a position or mm-hmm. share what they believe? And like, I look at my kids, I go, more than anything, I want them to be able to do that. Yeah. To be able to handle themselves. And I feel like that's why this environment is so ripe for growth, because it does offer those things in a different way.
So you would present those, to a prospective family, you would emphasize those.
Yeah, prospective family. What do you care about? Do you care about your child learning how to learn effectively, learning how to think and reason, and learning how to speak, to be able to articulate? And I think that I would share that with somebody. Mm-hmm. I learned something today from some really cool people that I got a chance to sit with.
Let's get back to a second. And won't go long, but I want to give, first of all, there are the question cards on the tables. I want to give, if you've got a question for Ben, or maybe just sort of in light of the conversations we've had today all the way through, just as I kind of wrap things up. If you want to jot a question down, Michelle and my daughter Hannah will be around. We grab those in just a minute. But I want to get back. We've talked about competition a lot, and I want to get back to, I mean, Eve, I want to hear some stories, by the way, of your professional athlete. If you hang out with Tiger, I mean, like, tell me something interesting. No, I
could tell you some interesting
stuff. No, I'm sure you could. But you said something that's very, I think there's a tension, and certainly within an organization that strives for true goodness and beauty, and we really care about excellence, and we are willing to say that's beautiful and that's not beautiful, it seems like we're at risk of maybe, help us find that balance between we need to be competitive, but at the same time, we are dealing almost at the point of being neurotic for a lot of kids. So what does that mean in the work you're doing?
Yeah, so you said on the podcast that we did recently, you know, isn't competition just like, you know, Chevrolet and apple pie and to America? And it really is. It's a part of the way Western society operates and runs. People ask me periodically when they hear me speak, you know, it sounds like you're against competition. And I would say that's not actually the question. The reality is it is the way our society runs and operates, and you have to figure out how to live in it and how to deal with it. What level are you going to participate in it? And how? And I think for a classical Christian world, it's important for us to think through, when you put the label Christian on something, you're now saying some very distinct things about it. And I would say, from my perspective, the first thing we're saying, when I think about Christian, I go, how loving are they? Because primarily, more than anything, if you pin Jesus down and ask him what's most important, he comes back with love. And I think so when we say we're Christian, do I want my student as they grow up, you know, if we look at a Christian school, do the kids come out more smart and competitive, or do they come out more loving? And there's a balance there, right? That's a very important thing we have to wrestle through. I don't think you'll ever have a parent come to you and complain if their kid comes home more loving and joyful. They're not going to come complaining to you. But they will come complaining to you if they're stressed out and have too much homework. Right, you probably have experienced these things. These are conversations we have, right? So for me, I think competition, you know, like when we come back to the competitive thing, we have to balance it. I was speaking recently and I said to this group of administrators, I think there's two types of students today. There are students who are ambitious and they're driven and they're going to go and they're going to charge it. Stress and anxiety is just a part of it. And they will swim great in our culture. And then there are students who are becoming more apathetic. And they are struggling, they don't know if they have what it takes, they feel the pressure, and they're like, these are the students that, you know, are checking out of life in a sense. They're having a very difficult time dealing with what they feel is expected and required of them. Especially even in the public school. You step in, you're on a track, you're supposed to know what you want to do by the time you're a junior, and then you have to have your first year of college done by the time you graduate. I mean, it's intense. And then extract meaning and morality from culture and replace it with metrics. Everything's a number. You know, metrics will make you miserable, ultimately. You know, so to the ability to tie back in, and so I think we have to figure out how do we balance those two. And competition is something that we have to be very thoughtful about and how we're facilitating it in people's lives.
So does that mean grades? I mean, where is it most likely to cause issues for us?
You know, I think there's a variety of factors. Obviously, I talk about it on four levels. You know, I think it's best characterized societally. You know, we have an economic competition. You know, students are growing up and they're looking at their futures and they're going, how am I going to become successful? You know, we're talking about students being happy and successful. You know, that seems to be the goal of the parent. Well, there's this economic drive. Am I going to be able to support my family eventually? Right. They're maybe not thinking about it as much, but they will get there. The academic competition is one that is certainly out there, and you see it. Characterized recently by the scam that went on where parents were paying for students to get into major universities. You know, I won't list the universities. But then the consumeristic competition, which would be, I mostly characterize it by the professionalization of youth sports. I was with a friend of mine who's a dad last night and his kid's in club baseball. And they treat these kids like professionals. You know, and they're 12. You're not Mike Trout at 12. You know, well, he was. At 12, because he was Mike Trout.
Right.
You know,
but
anyway.
Parent, yeah.
But then, and then the social competition is the layer. You know, I talk about the social competition being a competition for who's happiest or most respected playing itself out in non-reality. So the happiest part is, you know, social media is primarily a competition for who's happiest, with dissatisfaction being paraded in front of you. And then the gaming part of things, you know, people find a lot of respect in the gaming world. Mm-hmm. You know, so those things, it's infused in just how culture runs, and we're preparing students to go live in it. And so I think about this with my kids a lot. You know, so I love to have an environment where I can interchange with the people who are educating them on a regular basis about the things they're facing, you know, and how to navigate that together as a partner, as a dad, you know, with the teachers that love my kids and with the administrators. You know, that's a big deal, to be able to have these conversations with them and be taken seriously, honestly.
So let me shift to the parents real quickly. Again, as a parent, what can we do? We just had a panel on this around parent education, but what are the most urgent matters that we need to be attending to when it comes to our parents, given the environment that you're kind of tracking and your own experience as a parent?
Whew. I think everyone's walking into, you know, it's a bit complex. They all have different needs. I think you and I have seen this vividly in recent experiences we've had together. We live in a very individualistic culture. And when you're paying for education, in some sense, we almost feel like it should cater to everything that we want and need for our child. Plus, we have a society that says you should have everything you want and need. And oh, by the way, not just everything you want and need, but on your terms when you want it. Mm-hmm. You don't experience any of that with the parents that walk through your doors, right? So I think being able to balance the reality of the effects of society on the parents' mentalities as they're walking in the room, and then being able to love them well, even in the middle of that. Because, like, how do you love people out of individualism? Because that's how our world operates, and it shows up in your schools. All I want you to do is educate my kids so he's the most successful he could possibly be. Don't talk to me about anything else. But yet you have an opportunity to bring the greatest love and hope that the world has to bear on the family and the children, because they spend so much time with you in the community. Honestly, that's what I want. I may be rare. I'm all in with classical Christian education. But I think to really understand their needs and then to love them well at that place, you know, is what I would say.
Okay, good. Well, I want to give folks a chance to ask you any questions. So if there's interest in sort of have a question to Ben, if you want to write that down, if anybody's got, we're going to get Michelle on. Michelle's over there. If there's anybody's got a question, we can have her pick that up. You know, the idea, I think, around parent, back to just the world that our parents live in, is words like, or let me just say it this way, like the idea of love, and you've mentioned this many times, and it's the heart of a lot of what you do and a lot of what you think about.
Right.
It's also the heart of the gospel.
Sure.
I think familiarity breeds complacency. I don't think there's a school around that would say, well, of course, we're always about love, and that's just, but it goes into that hallmark, sticky sweet, we got it, not very practical, or maybe it's just everywhere and therefore kind of nowhere. So what does it look like, practically speaking? Because I know you were talking about one of the antidotes to a lot of anxiety today is getting kids out of self and getting, you know, like our house program, we have a very active house program, and part of what they're doing is they're going out and they're serving in the community,
yeah,
older mentoring younger. I mean, the more we build that type of life into our school, it seems like that's automatically curbing some of the anxiety that comes from the individualism.
Yeah, I think the way I would describe it is love is functional and structural to all of life. Like if you envision a building, and you know, buildings get built out of all kinds of things, I think love is one of the things that gives us architecture for all of life. And yet we wouldn't necessarily use words to talk about it that way. There's an interesting guy we've talked about named Tim Jennings, who's a board-certified psychiatrist in Tennessee. And he wrote a book called The God-Shaped Brain. He wrote another book called The God-Shaped Heart. And in those books, he goes on to show how what we believe about God and what we believe about love actually wires your brain a certain way. Like it shapes your brain. And I was at an event recently where he showed how anxiety and depression happens in the brain, and then how when love comes in, how it changes the way the brain is working. And I think this is really important for us to understand, because this is how God's designed it. And so in a practical sense, I think when we go back to the Great Commandment, I would think it would be one of those statements in the scriptures that is that one that we're all familiar with. Love God, love people. Love God, love people, love yourself, you know. But it's really love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all your strength. And in my own personal research, I peeled back the layers on each of those areas. I looked at the languages to try to understand what was really being said there. And ultimately what you have is, you know, the soul is relational, the whole person. You know, when you come into your schools, it is souls interacting with souls, teachers interacting with teachers, administration, students in relationship with one another. The soul is relational. So to love God with the soul is a relational endeavor. And then you have the emotional capacity of us, the way that we feel and have emotions. You know, to have a healthy emotional life is loving God with our heart. Loving God with your mind is a healthy intellectual life. And then ultimately, strength is power and influence, the way I go out into the world in my actions and live and serve. So those are very practical and tangible ways. Love is not ambiguous and just an emotional thing, but it actually filters down to all aspects of life and integrates itself into all of life. And ultimately, that's what I want for my kids, is I want them to grow up and be very loving individuals who know how to integrate that into all aspects of their life, their vocation, the way they think about life, the way they handle their passion and desire and emotional life, and the way they relate to others. And I think we cover a ton of ground there when we talk about love in a broader sense. Being consistent with how it's defined biblically as, you know, having a deep concern for the well-being of another, that would be ultimately what agape is. And so that's how I would answer that.
You see that, again, just practically, where do we see that lived out? How does that,
Yeah, it's lived out in everything that you do. It's lived out in your conversations. It's lived out on playgrounds. It's lived out in artwork, visually, you know, how things are displayed. It shows up in all kinds of how environments are even constructed. And yet we wouldn't necessarily think about love having an influence on those things.
Right.
And for us to take and have that ability to do that, I think, is very helpful, especially if that's what we're trying to communicate.
Right.
You know, we talk about shaping of the affections. We're talking about shaping what people love. Well, it'll be helpful to talk about love,
right,
if we're shaping what they love. And so, yeah, that's...
Yeah, that's good. Well, I know we're kind of winding down time. I just want to make sure, any questions out there? It's getting late. Oh, there's a question right here. Yep. Thanks, sir. So how do you best communicate the urgency and need for classical Christian education to 95% of the evangelical Christian parents that believe that public school is pretty good? Because that's really where you were. You were looking at it thinking, it's not only that, but you actually saw it in this missional idea of it with salt and light.
Yeah.
So what changed for you? And again, what would help frame that up just in your own journey?
You ask really hard questions. You know, I think when it comes down to a parent looking at their child in front of them, I think taking into account maybe what they're struggling with or what they're going through and the things that they're going to need to make it through all of life. The guy from Chick-fil-A, what was his first name?
Chris.
Mm-hmm. Mentioned a quote by Henry Cloud, basically having the necessary character to meet the demands of reality. I would talk to a parent about, do you feel like your child is developing everything that they need substantially from a standpoint of virtue to be able to deal with all of life? And, or are they just becoming good at something to be able to have a career or be successful? Being a well-rounded person is ultimately how I would communicate it. And I have these conversations with people who are believers that have their kids in public schools. Yep. And we go back and forth, which is really interesting. But
yeah, I should mention one thing that's been kind of inspired me to do. So in the spring, we actually set up, we call them focus groups. So we had about a dozen focus group conversations with no more than four parents, and I was specifically looking for parents who had only been at the school for 4 years or less. And so we sat in a lot of these meetings, and it was about a 45-minute meeting. And I encourage you to do these because, again, if you've been at it for a while, sometimes it's easy to forget what it is that both drew them to the school and their understanding of the school. It's fascinating asking the question, what is classical Christian education? And there wasn't any universal answer that was given there. But then getting back to just the very anecdotal, practical sense, back to this question of what really makes this a different environment compared to the school down the street.
Yeah.
And you really start hearing the points of awareness that my child is going somewhere beyond just getting into a college. I think that shift is important. So,
and I think a final comment on that from my standpoint, when Chick-fil-A, when they put up mindset as that first thing, I was like, here's the one thing about mindset. You can't change it for anybody. they've got to be wanting to have a shift. And the only way that that really happens for people is a consistent over time exposure to the things that they increasingly find valuable, and they go, you know what, I need to think about this differently. And so I don't know that it's that I can persuade somebody in one conversation, but over time, you know, help them shift the way they think about things. That's certainly a challenge that you all face, you know, with families and your schools.
Good. Other questions? We're almost out of time, so anybody else? Good. Well, Ben, I just want to say I really appreciate it. Thank you for your, it's been, and I would say you encourage you, find a Ben in your school, someone who's fairly new into the journey, because it's, again, for us, I've been at it for 15 years in a classical Christian school, it's easy to kind of, again, assume a certain way of understanding the world. And if we're going to be sensitive both to what's happening in the broader culture and just the journey of the parent coming in, doing these focus groups has been very enlightening and opening up questions about, well, how do we serve if this is where students are today and where parents are today?
Right.
It's
just
easy to miss the alignment there. So, fantastic. Well, let's thank Ben for being a part of this. Thanks so much, Ben. Yeah, awesome. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah,